Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, December 18th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 804 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, we'll be joined by Maha Husseini, the head of media and public engagement at Euromed Human Rights Monitor and an award-winning journalist, who has been in Gaza throughout the genocide, documenting it as she, her family, and her community tried to survive unbearable horrors and loss. Later on in the program, John will cover the Israeli military's assassination of senior Qassam Brigade's commander, Ra'ad Saad, in a blatant violation of the ceasefire. And just a quick note, we won't be having a program next Thursday, Christmas Day, and we wish everyone who is celebrating a happy holiday. But instead, we're going to have a special year-end questions and answer show on Tuesday, December 30th, at the usual time. You can send in your questions in advance if you want using the email address questions@electronicintifada.net. We'll also be taking questions from the live comments during the show. We hope it'll be a good opportunity to talk about the year that's passed and what we might expect in 2026. So bring your questions on any aspects of the topics we cover and we will have a lively discussion. We'll send out a reminder about the special questions and answers show by email a day or two before. So if you haven't signed up to our email list, now is a great time to do so, so you don't miss that reminder. Just go to electronicintifada.net and click Get Updates. And we hope to see you for this special show on December 30th. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip while shelling areas east of the so-called Yellow Line. It is also still preventing the entry of shelters and basic supplies during relentless storms, which have been collapsing tents and partially destroyed buildings on top of people. Israel has killed 394 Palestinians and injured nearly 1,100 since the October 10th alleged ceasefire, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza. On Wednesday, the ministry reported that at least one Palestinian was killed and another was injured in Israeli attacks. Mahmoud Bassel, spokesperson for the civil defense, gathered pieces of shrapnel in the aftermath of an Israeli attack on the center of Gaza City on Wednesday. 11 people were injured in the explosion. Reporter Saeed Hezbollah filmed that clip. Israeli forces shelled areas east of Jabalia refugee camp in the north and east of Khan Yunis and Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, while bulldozers were reported moving into the northeast areas of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, according to reports. On Tuesday, Israeli forces launched air attacks and fired shells within the so-called Yellow Line and opened fire into areas in central Gaza, including Deir al-Balah and the Barej refugee camp. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on Sunday, December 14th, that Israeli shelling and airstrikes targeted multiple locations over the weekend, including a strike on a car in a crowded Gaza City street on Saturday that killed at least 4 people and injured 25 bystanders. Reporter Hamdan Dahdou filmed ambulance crews and rescue workers gathering pieces of human flesh and body parts in the aftermath of the strike. 11 Palestinians were killed and more than 50 were injured in just a 48-hour period between Friday and Sunday. At least 16 deaths, including 3 children, have been reported over recent days as severe winter storms and heavy winds continue to collapse already fragile tents and partially destroyed buildings where many have sought last resort shelter from the dangerous cold. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, reported that multiple waterlogged buildings collapsed on families sheltering in them. Mohammed Tamous filmed the collapse of a home belonging to the Abu Safiya family in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza on December 12th. Civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Basal said that at least 17 residential buildings have completely collapsed and at least 90 have partially collapsed in the last week. He added that rains continue to flood tents, leaving thousands of families without shelter, as Israel continues to refuse to allow in adequate shelters, including prefabricated caravans, heavy machinery, and construction materials to protect people from the elements. Reporter Saad Hezbollah filmed a boy showing the damage that the screaming, quote, "We are drowning, O God. Where are the people? Where is humanity?" At least three children have died of hypothermia in the last week due to the cold and Israel's continued refusal to allow in necessary shelters and materials. 9-year-old Hadil Abdullah Hamdan was carried to a clinic in a blanket in the arms of a loved one on December 12th after dying in a displacement camp in Gaza City. Journalist Hamza Kureika filmed this clip. A 2-week-old infant, Mohammed Khalil Abu Al-Khair, died on Monday, December 15th, from extreme hypothermia even after being in intensive care for several days, medical sources reported. And on December 11th, an infant, Taim Al-Khawaja, also died from hypothermia in the beach refugee camp. A video clip from reporter Hassan Salem shows an elderly man carrying the infant's tiny body wrapped in a shroud. Jonathan Fowler of UNRWA told Al Jazeera that the agency, quote, has shelter supplies for more than a million people sitting outside the Gaza Strip that we could bring in. So there's a political choice to deny us the possibility of bringing that aid in. The Gaza government media office stated over the weekend that more than 250,000 displaced people have been directly affected by rainwater, floods, and landslides that have damaged their dilapidated tents. This disaster, the office added, quote, which we warned about, discussed, and predicted, comes within the context of the larger humanitarian catastrophe resulting from the genocidal war and the unjust siege imposed by the Israeli occupation on the Gaza Strip. The occupation continues to close the crossings, prevent the entry of relief aid and shelter materials, and prevent the entry of 300,000 tents, mobile homes, and caravans, as well as preventing the construction or preparation of alternative shelters for the displaced. Al-Shifa Hospital, which was the largest medical facility in Gaza and predates the Israeli state, and which was the target of numerous sieges, raids, and bombing attacks during the last 2 years of genocide, was also flooded, worsening the situation for patients and medical staff who are still unable to obtain basic medicine, equipment, and supplies for repairs to the building. Mahmoud Basal of the Civil Defense posted this video on Monday of water pouring into the reception and triage department from the damaged ceiling. Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum filmed himself touring the hollowed-out shell of the Turkish Friendship Hospital earlier this week. The hospital had been the only cancer treatment facility in Gaza until it was taken over by the Israeli army and destroyed from within.
Now in the Turkish Friendship Hospital, which is the sole cancer treatment facility across the strip, it was responsible for providing medical treatment for thousands of cancer patients in the strip. Now it has been completely lying in ruins. This area and this hospital in particular has been under the Israeli military control for more than 2 years, and it was used by the Israeli military as a key command and control center where they have destroyed after once they have finished their military operations in the strip. We can see different Hebrew writing being written here on these walls where children and elderly people used to receive medical treatment. But what's so alarming to see on the ground is the scale of devastation. Most of these equipment here that we saw at this hospital have been destroyed. Corridors are simply seen as corridor of nightmares. People are quite scared to enter this building. Specifically, it's located near Nitzarim corridor, and these medical wards have been massively destroyed by the Israeli military. We are so cautious while we're moving, given that the Israeli military has turned this medical facility into a lifeless wasteland. We can see here the scale of devastation. And basically, they have left behind no medical department standing. And this has a great impact on the ability of cancer patients to receive their treatment across the strip. We can here see these corridors quite filled with devastation and destruction. And what we have heard from Gaza's medical teams that this hospital was one of the most sophisticated hospitals in the strip to provide medical treatment. But now it has been in a state of chaos, destruction, that will take years in order to be rehabilitated again.
That was Tarek Abu Azoum at the site of the Turkish Friendship Hospital in Gaza. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed three children this week in separate attacks. On December 13th, Israeli soldiers shot and killed 16-year-old Mohammed Iyad Abarha in a town northwest of Jenin. According to documentation by Defense for Children International Palestine, or DCIP, quote, Mohammed allegedly participated in confrontations with Israeli forces alongside other young Palestinians who were throwing explosive devices toward a heavily armored Israeli military vehicle during a military incursion into Silat al-Harithiya when he was shot from a distance of about 15 to 20 meters away. He was targeted by Israeli soldiers who were positioned inside a Palestinian home. The teenager fell to the ground and several soldiers dragged him toward the entrance of the house, DCIP stated. The soldiers then prevented an ambulance from approaching Mohammed and left him bleeding for around 10 minutes. They placed Mohammed inside a military vehicle and then left the town. The Palestinian Health Ministry then received news of his death later that evening. His body was also confiscated, DCIP said. Ayed Abu Aktesh, Accountability Program Director at DCIP, said, quote, Mohammed grew up in a hyper-militarized environment where Israeli soldiers regularly carry out military incursions into Palestinian communities, harass and detain Palestinians at checkpoints, and kill Palestinians, including children, with live ammunition with complete impunity. Israeli soldiers continue targeting children with deadly force with no accountability because world leaders allow them to act without consequence. On December 15th, Israeli forces stormed the village of Tuku, east of Bethlehem, firing live ammunition from their positions in the center of the town, according to local media sources. Israeli soldiers shot 16-year-old Amar Sabah in the chest, killing him. Less than 24 hours later, an Israeli settler shot another 16-year-old child in the head near the northern entrance of Tuku. Mohib Ahmed Ali Jabrin was killed instantly, and another youth suffered injuries. The Wafa news agency said that the murder happened shortly after Palestinians finished funeral ceremonies for Amar Sabah. According to the mayor of Tuku, mourners had begun to leave when several youths remained near the town's entrance. A settler then exited his vehicle and fired live ammunition at them without warning. DCIP says that in 2025, Israeli forces and settlers killed 54 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In their year-end report, the human rights group says that 2025 has shown, quote, with devastating clarity that Palestinian children are facing a crisis not of law, but of enforcement. International protections exist. International obligations are clear. Yet the international community continues to shield Israel and its forces starve, torture, disappear, and kill Palestinian children with unprecedented brutality. Quote, awareness alone is not enough, DCIP added. Palestinian children deserve safety, justice, and a future free from violence. They deserve a world willing to uphold the laws created to protect them. Meanwhile, in Nur Shams refugee camp in the north, Palestinian residents are being forced to leave their homes following demolition orders by the Israeli army of 25 residential buildings and houses. Residents of Nur Shams were subjected to humiliating searches by Israeli forces as they tried to collect belongings from their homes ahead of the demolitions, which began today, December 18th. The entire camp has been under siege by the Israeli army since January 2025. Roland Friedrich, the director of UNRWA affairs for the occupied West Bank, said on Tuesday that, quote, "This new demolition order fits the pattern we have seen too often this year, with Israeli forces destroying homes to enable their long-term control over the camps in the northern West Bank, permanently altering their topography." In activism news from the UK, six political prisoners in British jails associated with the banned group Palestine Action have now been on hunger strike for a month or more. My colleague Asa Winstanley recently interviewed the sister of Kamran Ahmed, one of the prisoners, as well as a spokesperson for the group Prisoners for Palestine, which supports the hunger strike. The hunger strikers are demanding to be released on bail, the right to a fair trial, and an immediate end to what they say is their persecution by the British government. Most have already been held on remand far longer than the normal six-month maximum, which the law allows before trial. This week, supporters of the imprisoned activists, including MP Zara Sultana and two doctors, have maintained a presence outside the HMP Bronzefield prison, where Kesser Zohra is held, while she's nearing 50 days of her hunger strike. Prisoners for Palestine says that as of Wednesday, Zohra reported symptoms requiring urgent medical intervention. Quote, "Despite repeated calls for emergency care, prison staff have so far refused entry to ambulances and delayed treatment overnight, prompting Zahra Sultana MP and medical professionals to stage a night-long campout outside the prison. Fellow hunger striker John Sink reported that he saw an ambulance at around 9 p.m. on December 16th being turned away by the prison. Earlier today, December 18th, after more than 12 hours of a sustained protest outside the prison, an ambulance was finally allowed to reach Kesser Zohra. MP Zahra Sultana stated, quote, "From 2 a.m. in freezing temperatures, we were forced to protest for more than 12 hours before an ambulance was finally dispatched to HMP Bronzefield so that Kesser Zohra could receive the urgent medical care she needs. Just as Keir Starmer's Labour government has enabled genocide in Gaza, it is now enabling the deaths of Palestine Solidarity hunger strikers inside UK prisons. We demand immediate bail for all remand political prisoners." Rahma Hoxha, the sister of imprisoned hunger striker T. Hoxha, sent the Electronic Intifada this update on her sister's condition on Wednesday.
"Hoxha, and my sister is T. Hoxha. She is currently on hunger strike for the liberation of the Palestinians and for the five demands, which are shut Elbit down, immediate bail, deprescribe, end all censorship, and the right to a fair trial. She believes that once everything gets stripped away from you, there is no autonomy or choice, and that the only thing you have left is your body, as you have full control over it, and she's using that against the system. My sister is on day 38 of her hunger strike. She is weak, she's feeling dizzy, she's constantly having headaches and constantly feeling nauseous. Even though she's feeling very weak, she's very firm on her demands. And she's struggling to drink and take medications as she feels sick and unwell. She is really struggling. She was hospitalized and had to discharge herself against medical advice, as they wouldn't let her speak to her solicitor or her next of kin. I don't think people realize how serious this hunger strike is, as on day 35, you have organ failure, you can have brain damage, and you can have a heart attack. The government really needs to engage with these demands. These demands are very reasonable. The longer this goes on, the scarier it gets for her and for my family. My sister shouldn't even have to be in prison. She's been on remand for over a year, and her trial is not until April 2026. This is her second hunger strike. The first hunger strike she had, the guards called her a terrorist, even though her trial has not happened yet. And she said it feels like the government is trying to bury them alive and for them to go quietly. She also said that once you are labeled a terrorist, it's like entering a black hole. As once you have a label, society is conditioned to accept it and not ask questions. I feel as though this fate has taken away a piece of me and shattered my heart. My sister is my best friend, my soulmate, and my mother figure. I don't want to lose my sister. I don't want to have to imagine a life without her. I need her in my life, and I love her so much, and I'm honestly so grateful for her. She always cheers me up and motivates me. And even from prison, she keeps me in check. She makes me do my homework and revision. My sister's always there for me. She used to take me out on hot chocolate dates, shopping sprees, and she would even come to every appointment I had. And now it's just so lonely without her, and I really miss her. And this made me become more independent. I wish the state wasn't so cruel. At one point, the prison took away my phone number for a month, and that month was a difficult period for me, as I only get to visit my sister once a week, because it's really hard to go visit her and have school. And I have to bring an adult with me every time. And the prison is really far. But I am grateful I get to speak to my sister. I get to see my sister because I know that the Palestinians that are being detained in Israel, their families don't even know where they are. And their families don't know whether they are alive or dead. The government really needs to engage with these demands. In the 1980s, 10 Irish hunger strikers died. The state let them die, and that is what they're trying to do now.
That was Rahma Hoxha, whose sister T is on a hunger strike at HMP Peterborough. We'll continue to follow this story on electronicintifada.net. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Gaza's Fishers Tempt Fate to Feed the Hungry by Hassan Harzala, writing from Gaza. Break of dawn in Gaza used to have its own rhythm, smell, and sounds, Hassan writes. Excuse me. As fishers set out to sea, the sound of the engines on their vessels would carry far and wide on a salty breeze. The calm belied the bustle that would come as markets filled up and restaurants across Gaza prepared for customers filing in for fresh fish. Fishing is more than a job in Gaza. Gaza's is a maritime population. Fishing has always been part of the culture, part of the collective memory here. It is the kind of living that is passed down from fathers and grandfathers who have lived by the shore for generations. But over the past 2 years, the same sea, once a source of livelihood for an estimated 110,000 people in Gaza, has instead borne witness to great suffering, its shoreline a last refuge for those trying to survive amid famine, bombardment, and siege. Since the age of 10, Muhammad al-Nahal, 26, would accompany his father and older brothers on daily fishing trips aboard their launch or small boat. It was a daily routine and a family ritual, a tradition passed down through generations in a family that has always lived by the sea. Before the genocide, Israel's navy would allow Gaza's fishers to sail up to 6 nautical miles into the sea, far short of the 12 miles they should have been allowed under international law. But Muhammad said the sea was generous enough. We would cast the nets for just a short while, and because there were so many fish, we used to fill 10 to 15 boxes, each with around 15 kilos of different kinds of fish. Pricing was simple, from the cheaper but always popular sardines, 3 kilos for $3, Muhammad remembered happily, to the more expensive Denise or sea bream, never more than $15. Fishing was easier. It took less effort and less time. The engines ran on fuel and the sea offered bounty. From the first days of the genocide, however, the sea seemed to close its doors on Gaza's fishers. Israeli patrol boats watched every movement. The waves carried the smell of gunpowder instead of salt. The winds, the sound of bombings. Fishing was no longer a daily routine. It became a deeply precarious task that could end in death or detention. One night we were out when we found ourselves directly in the line of fire, said Samir Tabassi, 21, a fisherman local to Khan Yunis. Shells were fired at us. One landed in the water, luckily not hitting us. As we were coming out of the sea, we were shot at on the shore. One of our friends was injured, and the tents along the beach were also targeted, resulting in one death. Gaza's fishing sector has suffered a catastrophic collapse, according to the UN, and the sector operates at just 7.3% of its pre-genocide production capacity. This dramatic decline is having a devastating impact on food security, income generation, and community resilience across Gaza. As winter approaches, there has never been more need for fishers in Gaza. But cold winds and high waves test their remaining fragile boats, while the constant threat of targeting makes every trip to the sea a potentially deadly undertaking. "Still, they go," said Samir. "They have little choice but to continue risking their lives just to put food on the table." Those are excerpts from "Gaza's Fishers Tempt Fate to Feed the Hungry" by Hassan Hirzala, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Ahmed Muin Abu Amsha, a music teacher, posted this video of him leading a group of kids in a song on the beach during a break between storms. He writes, quote, "Despite the strong winds, heavy rain, and the harsh cold of the storm, we gathered together. We were soaked by the rain. The weather was unforgiving, but we refused to let these conditions take joy away from the children. In the middle of the storm, we chose music. We chose laughter, singing, and warm moments that reminded us all that happiness can still exist, even in the hardest times. Seeing the smiles on the children's faces was worth every drop of rain. Today, we didn't just escape the weather, we brought joy back to their hearts. Music is stronger than the storm. Joy is stronger than the cold."
Me!
Ow! I feel good!
That was Ahmed Muin Abu Amsha in Gaza and his students. And finally, I wanted to just take a minute to talk about my friend and a steadfast supporter of the Electronic Intifada, Barbara Lubin. Barbara died on Saturday, surrounded by her family. Barbara Lubin co-founded the Middle East Children's Alliance in 1988 with Howard Levine in Berkeley, California, and dedicated her entire life to making the world better for children from the U.S. to Palestine, Iraq, and Lebanon. She was an anti-Vietnam War activist. She fought for the rights of disabled children here in the States, helping to write legislation that would be the precursor to the Americans with Disabilities Act. And she became a passionate and stubborn anti-Zionist activist who pissed off all the right people and never backed down from a righteous fight over Palestinian rights. She defied Bill Clinton's murderous U.S. sanctions in Iraq in the 1990s by smuggling medicine in her suitcases when no other U.S. organization dared to. She and Mecca funded playgrounds and community projects in Lebanon, especially in the Palestinian refugee camps. And in Palestine for decades, she worked with community activists, farmers, artists, doctors, and cultural workers to provide children with a life of dignity, joy, and safety. And personally, Barbara was a major figure in my life. She helped shape my politics and my principles, and she loved me like a daughter, for which I will be forever grateful. In a tribute to Barbara, the staff at Mecca says, "Barbara's life was dedicated to the idea that what was good for her kids was good for everyone's kids. This led her to build community and solidarity beyond national, ethnic, and religious boundaries. She leaves a profoundly important legacy, not only in Mecca, but in the lives of everyone who knew her." And Michelle Shahadeh, who is the former president of the Mecca board and was a member of the LA 8, a group of Palestine solidarity activists who were persecuted by the federal government for years, beginning in the 1980s, wrote that, quote, "Barbara showed us what it means to choose humanity over comfort, justice over silence, and love over fear. She taught us that solidarity is not an idea, but a lifelong practice. We are better for having walked this path with her, and poorer for her absence, yet richer beyond measure for what she gave us. We love you, Barbara. We are grateful for your work, and we carry on your fight, your biting and caustic sense of humor, and your enormous, noble heart. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague, Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you for all of that, and particularly the tribute to Barbara Lubin. I knew her for more than 30 years. Yeah. Exactly 30 years, and she was just an incredible person, a fighter, fearless, and she loved working for justice for people all over the world, but particularly in Palestine. And she fought for children in Palestine as if they were her own children. That was what I always saw in her. And I think I learned something from her too, which is that, you know, Middle East Children's Alliance, which she co-founded, which is a wonderful organization working in Gaza right now, working across Palestine, providing practical support for people as they've been doing for decades, but without compromising on political principles, on demands for liberation. And I learned that you can do that. You can be there for people in practical ways, but not sacrifice your politics. So Barbara was just amazing at that.
She was, she was relentless, and she was, she was just committed. She was committed to funding what Palestinians needed to make their communities safer, to make their kids healthier, to give especially children places of joy and dignity. Barbara, her impact is immeasurable, and I miss her very, very much already. So there will be much more to say about Barbara and Mecca, of course, and her legacy is vast. I know a lot of people have been mourning her loss all over the world. So thank you, Ali. And we are now going to go to an interview that we pre-recorded earlier this morning in Gaza with Maha Husseini of Euromed Human Rights Monitor. So let's go to that interview.
And listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream, I'm Ali Abunema here with my colleague Nora Barrows-Friedman. In Gaza, residents wake up to find a yellow block in their neighborhood. Once they see it, they grab what they can and flee, knowing their homes will be demolished and that they will never be able to return. This is how Israel continues to forcibly displace Palestinians in the Strip, even after the ceasefire agreement. These are the words of Euromed Human Rights Monitor talking about how Israel is marking the so-called yellow line, dividing the area where Palestinians are allowed to remain following the so-called ceasefire agreement in October, and the large part of Gaza still under full Israeli military occupation. Euromed adds, these blocks carry only one message, leave or be killed. But as people are forced to move yet again, they face a dire situation. With the vast majority of Gaza's housing stock destroyed, people across the territory are without shelter amid harsh winter storms. In recent days, at least 14 Palestinians have died from these winter conditions, according to the health ministry, including an 8-month-old baby. Meanwhile, Israel continues its attacks across Gaza, and since the ceasefire, almost 400 Palestinians have been killed in ongoing Israeli bombing or from previous injuries. We're joined now from Gaza by Maha Husseini. She is the head of media and public engagement at Euromed Human Rights Monitor and an award-winning journalist who has been in Gaza throughout the genocide.
Hi, Ali. Hi,
Maha. Welcome. I'm just saying, Maha, welcome to the program. You have been in Gaza throughout the genocide, documenting it as you and your community tried to survive. Maha, we welcomed you on the live stream once before. It was on October 16, 2023, less than 10 days into the genocide, and we're so pleased to have you back now. Thank you for the extraordinary work you and your colleagues are doing.
Hi, Maha.
Thank you, Ali. Hey, Nora, also thank you for having me. And yes, I think it's been over 2 years now, and I never imagined that I would make it actually to appear again with you after this genocide. But here we go. We survived, and we will talk about the past 2 years now.
We're very glad you're here, and we wish to see you many more times, but always in better circumstances, God willing. Maha, I want to first ask you about this horrifying incident. On December 10th, an Israeli military bulldozer ran over a wounded Palestinian child, cutting his body in half while he was still alive, after shooting him and preventing medical aid from reaching him. According to the documentation done by Euromed field workers, Israeli forces first injured 16-year-old Zahir Nasser Shamia, who is from Jabalia camp. He lay on the ground bleeding, with no one able to reach him due to continuous gunfire. Minutes later, a military bulldozer advanced towards him and deliberately ran him over while he was still alive on the ground, splitting his body in two. What can you tell us about the circumstances of this brutal killing? And are you seeing a pattern of such killings right now in Gaza?
Yeah, the killing of Zahir Shamia is actually the latest of a long series of deliberate killing of civilians, particularly also children, and also after killing them or wounding them, reigning over them. The case of Zahir Shamia, I talked to his family directly, and they told me that Zahir was actually not very close to the yellow line, and we will talk about how the yellow line is becoming a lethal, actually, border for Palestinians here in Gaza. But Zahir was with his friends in Jabalia, near the in the northern Gaza Strip, of course. And he was suddenly shot after the Israeli army also advanced to the area. He was suddenly shot in the head, most likely by a quadcopter drone. But even if it was a quadcopter drone or an Israeli sniper shooting him directly, which we this is also there are also cases we documented of Israeli snipers inside the yellow area shooting at Palestinians outside the yellow area. Whether it was by a sniper or a quadcopter, this means that the Israeli army knew exactly who they were shooting at. They were able to identify even the identity of this child because of the AI techniques they rely on and identifying civilians and shooting at them and across Gaza. So he was directly shot in the head, and then he lay on the ground bleeding. His friends, of course, did not manage to reach out to him or approach him because the Israeli army started even firing smoke bombs to prevent anyone from approaching the child. After that, they advanced towards the area, and most likely by a bulldozer or a tank. According to his family members, it was a bulldozer who ran over him. Zahir was particularly, according to eyewitnesses, still moving his head while the Israeli bulldozer ran him over. So he was still alive. And this is actually something we documented over the past two years. There were multiple cases in which Israeli forces deliberately killed Palestinian civilians by running them over with tanks or bulldozers. For example, let me just bring some examples of the part of this such incidents. For example, on the 29th of February 2024, that's just around 3 months into the genocide, Israeli forces killed an elderly man, a 60-year-old Jamal Ashour. He was in the Saitoun neighborhood in the south of Gaza City. Testimonies actually confirmed that he was arrested, zip tied, even and interrogated before he was run over by an Israeli vehicle. Of course, the Israeli vehicle, just to imagine the horrifying incident, the Israeli vehicle ran him over from the bottom of his body until the upper part of his body so that they can inflict the maximum suffering physical and physically and psychologically. This is also one of the long series of incidents we documented. Also on the 27th of June, Israeli forces stormed a home in Shija'iya neighborhood in the east of Gaza City. They expelled an elderly woman and her family, and then they used them as human shields in a military zone, in a combat zone. After that, they put the woman on the ground and they ran over her. These are actually only two of many other incidents we documented over the past 2 years. And they demonstrate actually a clear and repeated pattern of deliberately using heavy military machinery to kill civilians, including children, the elderly, particularly, and the wounded and displaced Palestinians. What happened to Zahir Shamia is actually, we can say, fairly say, that it's part of a wider systematic practice rather than an isolated act.
I mean, I remember that first incident of the elder who was zip tied and and then run over, and that image. I don't think those of us who saw that image can never get it out of our mind. What happens to the human body, and that another human was in this massive vehicle and deliberately, you know, made the choice to flatten him into an unrecognizable shape. And the fact that this keeps happening is just, it's unbearable, to say the least. What happened to Zahir was as you said, near the yellow line, which is vague and invisible, and it keeps moving ever westward, you know, squeezing Gaza into a smaller and smaller space. Your organization, Euromed, says that although the location of the yellow line is defined in the October 2025 ceasefire agreement between the Israeli government and Palestinian armed factions, the Israeli army continues to expand the occupied area and annex additional land in Gaza. Maha, can you talk about what this process of ongoing displacement looks like? You know, in addition to such horrifying killings, what effect is this process having? Where are people being displaced from, and where are they going, especially in this time of just a brutal winter storm season?
Yeah, actually, the yellow line has become a nightmare for all Palestinians across the Gaza Strip, even those who are not close to the yellow line. Even the color yellow of the yellow blocks, etc., has become a nightmare for Palestinians. And to give it more background and context, the area near the so-called yellow line is actually a clear example of how displacement in Gaza is being carried out in practice. And as you said, and as your Med Monitor documented, its location was defined clearly in the October 2025 ceasefire agreement. But Israeli forces, since that day, since the 10th of the, October 2025, have continued to push beyond it, expanding the occupied zone through, of course, live fire, bulldozing, and aerial attacks. Also, they shoot directly at homes, at civilians, civilian gatherings, etc. Of course, the expansion is not announced formally. It is enforced on the ground only through fear and violence and the killing of civilians, like, of course, Zahir Shamia and many others who were killed near the yellow line after the ceasefire. What this creates actually is a constant state of forced movement among Palestinians. People are being displaced primarily from the northern and eastern part of Gaza, which the yellow line actually surrounds Gaza from all directions except the west part, because there is the sea, of course, in the west. So it's from the north, the east, and also the south. It actually swallows around 53% of the total area of the Gaza Strip. So these people actually get forcibly expelled under this violence. Tanks advance, homes are demolished, and anyone who remains in this area after they see the yellow blocks, they risk being shot at. And to talk about the process, how it happens and how they expand this area, there are large cement yellow blocks that they place as a border to the yellow line. And day after day, the Israeli bulldozers advance and they push these yellow blocks towards the neighborhoods. What people actually, we have documented several places where people slept at night, actually, knowing that, and they were comfortable that they were away from the yellow line and they were in the safe area. They woke up in the morning and they saw the yellow block at their doorstep. So they grabbed what they could and they ran away. Days later, they approached the area, of course, to see that their homes was completely destroyed. The area was completely devastated, and the Israeli military has actually occupied this area. Families are actually pushed south and west into increasingly overcrowded areas, including Western Gaza City, also parts of Deir el-Balah and areas of Khan Yunis that are themselves repeatedly bombed and even lack basic services. Of course, many of those people who were happy that they returned to their homes, although they were severely damaged, they were happy that they survived. Their homes were survived through 2 years of genocide, and now they are getting demolished through or during the ceasefire, which is very disappointing for these families. They were celebrating that their homes were still standing. Even some of them tried to bring some life into these homes by getting internet, electricity, etc., trying to get solar panels and to feel settled a little bit after all these displacement. And now they are getting displaced and they have nowhere to go, of course, because the western parts of Gaza City and the northern, the Gaza Strip in particular, are very overcrowded with tents. And you can see the images of all these tents surrounding the western parts of Gaza City and also in other areas. These end up in makeshift tents, of course, with no basic services. And let me just put the yellow line in the broader context. To understand what is happening near the yellow line, it is also important to place in the broader context of an externally backed plan to redraw Gaza through military control. We have, for example, documented and obtained information indicating that a U.S.-supported plan seeks to divide the Gaza Strip into two red and green zones, separated by this yellow line, which is becoming a very, very dangerous for civilians. Under this plan, more than half of Gaza is effectively designated as a closed military zone under dire Israeli control. And according to the plan we have obtained information on, it actually in the future plans to move Palestinians from the western parts, which they are pushing Palestinians to the western parts of Gaza. They are trying to move them from these western parts into the eastern parts of Gaza, and then take over the western parts, which of course taking over the coast, the coast of Gaza and all the parts that are actually where Palestinians are actually trying to have a life, like fishing, etc. So this is not just a matter of dividing Gaza or occupying more land. No, it's part of a broader plan that seeks to take over the Gaza Strip as a whole. and put Palestinians, of course, in caravans in this eastern area, which resembles very much the ghettos where Palestinians are actually checked before going to their homes, and they are actually kept in this area, not allowed to go to any parts of the Gaza Strip.
Those are the concentration camps that Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, is championing, the so-called alternative secure communities. And Maha, are people, you working for a human rights organization and documenting these crimes, you're very aware of a lot of these details. How aware are people in Gaza in general about these kinds of plans? Do they talk about it? Do they follow that news, or are people just focused on survival? The news about these kinds of plans to displace them from here to there. Are they aware of that? Do they talk about it, or is that something that you would be more aware of because you're obviously very engaged in researching and documenting these things?
No, such incidents, actually, everyone talks about them. We all know about them, and we circulate the information because we know that what happens to others will eventually happen to us. We know that it's like, and I'm quoting someone who I interviewed, he said that it's like a fire in a neighborhood, and it's coming towards you, and you can do nothing towards it. So it's not we know that it would not be an isolated incident. That's why we follow closely the news, even those who are who have no connection with human rights organizations or media or etc. People, locals in general, actually closely follow these news because they want to know what will happen next, what will happen to them. Although they are, of course, preoccupied by survival tasks, daily survival tasks, but this also is a very important part of their attempts to survive, actually. They want to understand the context, what's happening on the ground. And it has been always that Gazans actually follow the news. They are educated politically, and they know the map, the political map in the area. So it's not like we are preoccupied with, for example, surviving tasks. No, we document, we follow up with concern these news, and we know that we might be next in any given moment. As I live in the west of Gaza, which is the area where the Israeli army pushes residents to it, I follow these news not as a human rights worker, but also as a Palestinian who is concerned that these lines will push towards my area and also forcibly expel me from my neighborhood.
Yeah, so nobody in Gaza feels secure, and everyone wants to know what will happen. But Maha, I want to ask you a little bit more about that day-to-day struggle for survival. It's been 2 months since the so-called ceasefire took effect. We know that there are still bombings, there are shootings, there are still people being killed. Let's say they slowed things down. They didn't stop killing people, but it's instead of 100 people a day, maybe it's a few people a day. But for each of those families, it's and for everyone in Gaza, it's an ongoing horror. But talk about what has changed and what has not changed for yourself and for people across Gaza. What's your daily life like now in terms of things like availability of food, medical care, and other basic needs? Do you see any areas where there is some greater availability? Just give us a sense of those day-to-day aspects of life.
Yeah, it's been more than 2 months after the ceasefire agreement, and very little we can say that has changed in any meaningful sense. For people in Gaza, the word ceasefire does not actually reflect the daily reality on the ground. This is only, we can say that these are only headlines in the media, not what's happening, what's actually happening on the ground. While there are actually people who are talking about the ceasefire and how the food was allowed in, finally after around a year or around 8 months of starvation in Gaza, yes, there is food that is coming in, but it's not all kinds of food and it's not the nutritious food that is coming in. For example, we have finally seen chocolate juice in the markets, which has been banned for the past year. But also there is there are very, very severe restrictions on the entry of chicken, for example, eggs. These have been allowed only over the past 2 or 3 weeks only. And we have documented that the Israeli military and the Israeli authorities particularly, they are limiting and instructing traders in Gaza not to get in any nutritious food, meaningful food.
When you say that chicken is coming in, Maha, just, you know, just very basic things like, so is that, you know, the economy has been destroyed in Gaza. People aren't going to work. Maybe, you know, some number of people are going to work, but I expect that the largest number of the population is not employed. So is the distribution of food aid, or are people expected to go and buy chicken? And if so, where do they get money from to be able to meet these basic needs? Talk us through some of these realities that are just hard for us outside to see.
Yeah, no, actually what's been coming in mostly has been part of trade, like goods that people have to buy, not as aid. There is aid that is coming in, but in very, very limited amounts. People actually have been, let's say they have been, they don't have money now after 2 years of attempts to get flour, like a bag of flour. For example, we used to buy the bag of flour in hundreds of dollars. And these people invested in trying to keep their children alive by getting flour. And you know, the crisis, the flour crisis, etc., over the past 2 years. And they have spent all their money on trying to survive during the genocide. So most of them now, after the ceasefire, cannot actually get the food that they were wishing that would be coming in into Gaza. I honestly don't know how they get or how they survive, because it's unimaginable that these have lost their jobs. Of course, even before the genocide, around 51% of the youth in Gaza were unemployed. The total unemployment rate was around 43%. And now you can imagine how the situation is after the Israeli destruction of around 80% of businesses in Gaza. People have also lost their jobs internationally. I mean, if they were working with international organizations, most of them also lost their jobs because they were unable to resume their jobs, and also because of the restrictions on banks in Gaza, on money transfers, etc. These organizations were unable to pay to their employees, so they closed their offices in Gaza, etc. It's a struggle, actually. Even fishermen, I was yesterday talking to a fisherman who was detained by the Israeli authorities, by the Israeli, forces in Gaza, off the Gaza coast. They are even preventing fishermen from fishing in the allowed area. Of course, during the genocide, the allowed area was zero. Before the genocide, it varied between 3 to 6 nautical miles. Now the fishermen are risking their lives in order to get a living or make a living, and they get detained, they get killed, shot at directly, including children. So basically, this is part of the plan to make Gaza unlivable, to prevent any attempts to make a living for Palestinians. And this is very clear through all these means, all these techniques that are enforced to prevent Palestinians from even farming. You know, the eastern parts of Gaza used to constitute a very large part of farming lands for Palestinians. Now they lost their farming lands, etc. So they have to rely on goods in editing fruits, for example, or vegetables, etc. And this is what made the crisis worse during the starvation. People were saying that Gaza has very vast farmlands. Why don't you rely on these farmlands so that you can get vegetables, etc.? But the fact is that the Israeli forces were deliberate in actually burning also these farmlands and preventing anyone from reaching their areas. And now they are annexed as part of the yellow area and the occupied zone.
It's relentless. It's so relentless, Maha. And, you know, you yourself, you've spent the past 2 years during this genocide working, reporting, and documenting these horrific crimes day after day, hour by hour. If we may ask, how are you and your colleagues doing, and what can, you know, what keeps you going?
This is a question that I have been asked repeatedly, actually, and never have I knew how to answer it. Because there is something that pushes you through, that pushes you to continue working, because you know that you are, if you do not document, if you do not work, no one will. And it's not true, because there are also Palestinians who are doing your work, but you feel this enormous responsibility to keep going. And especially when you see that there is something in your work that that annoys the perpetrators. And this is when you know that you're doing something right, even if you do not actually make a difference on the ground, even if it does not, the work you do does not reach, for example, the criminal court or the International Court of Justice, etc. You know that there is a slight thing that is making the perpetrators uncomfortable committing their crimes. And it is clear in the practices against Palestinian journalists and also Palestinian human rights defenders across the or throughout the past 2 years. They have been systematically targeting these people who are documenting on the ground what's happening. And honestly, every time that I heard that a colleague journalist or a colleague human rights worker was killed, detained, or targeted in any other way, it was... You would think that it would be a reason for me to get scared and just quit my job or just take a pause, for example, during the genocide. But actually, I was surprised that it pushed me to keep going and even to be more furious in my work, in my reporting. And it helped me a lot because I lived this genocide and I knew what it meant. Every quote I got from an eyewitness, of course, for example, or a victim, etc., I could reflect on it. I could understand what they meant by, for example, saying that we cannot find something to eat. Because when I went to, for example, interview people who were starving, I myself was actually struggling to keep alive and to secure food. And it has nothing to do with being able to buy food or etc., because we had money, but literally there was nothing in the market to buy. We were struggling, only thinking what we can do, what we can eat, and it reached to the point that I was thinking that even if we reach a point that we cannot find anything to eat, can we eat the tree leaves, for example? So you reach this point that you are thinking all the time, you are consumed psychologically by the thoughts of how to survive. So when I went to these people, I knew what they meant. For example, when they talked about displacement, I myself was displaced around 8 times across the past 2 years. I lost my home, etc. I lost part of my home, of course, etc. But yeah, it helped a lot for locals here, local journalists and human rights workers to reflect on what they were living. And yeah, I never thought actually that I would make it. Every day was or felt like my last day. Honestly, I'm not just exaggerating, but this, yeah, we woke up every day thinking that this would be our last day and that we need to do what we have to do as quickly as possible. So that we were actually running against time to document stories, etc. And every time I got a story out, I felt a little triumph, a little victory that I survived enough to get this story out. And now let's go to the other story, etc. So it was relentless, actually. Our work, our efforts were relentless. And I don't know, honestly, how we got this energy. Because after the ceasefire, we kind of collapsed. We tried to process what was going on throughout the past 2 years. This was a time to cry, to process what has been happening, the losses, the enormous losses we have gone through. And we just, during the genocide, we didn't care. We didn't think. We didn't have even the time to understand what we were losing. I'm not just proud of the work we have done as Euromed Monitor, but also of all other locals, journalists, and human rights workers, because everyone who reached this point and did not abandon their job, of course, I know that they knew at some point that they would be killed at any given moment. And despite this, they kept on going and they kept working. So, yeah, here we go.
Well, Maha, you know, I, of course, can't compare our situation with your situation in Gaza, but I can identify when I listen to you reflecting on your experience, I can identify with a lot of it because, you know, we often, you know, you have to find within yourself reserves of strength you didn't know you have. We didn't expect that this genocide would continue as long as it has continued and is continuing. You know, we didn't know what to expect, but we thought it can't last more than a few months, or then we reached a year and then 2 years. And we didn't expect to be covering it like this continuously, week after week, day after day. And I have to say, you know, I want to say this to you now, Maha, that seeing all the journalists and all the human rights workers in Gaza who are from Gaza doing the work they do, and especially you, I'm not saying that now just to because you're here, but I have been following you closely and I saw how you and others, you know what I mean, but you had that spirit all the way through. And I personally got a lot of strength from seeing you, because I would say, well, if Maha can do it, if Maha and her colleagues can do it, then what I'm asked to do is much, much less than what you're doing. So I want to tell you that you have been a tremendous example for us, and you've been a source of strength for us.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ali. Actually, yes, this was part of the responsibility, because we felt that if we give up, others outside of Gaza will actually give up. So we kept going so that to give you energy. I know it was supposed to be the other way through, but yeah.
Well, it went both ways, because a lot of people in Gaza have also told us that when they see people outside Gaza talking about Gaza, rallying, demonstrating, writing, that gives them strength too. And that's what I want to close our conversation with, because, you know, there are many people around the world watching this interview who have been very active over the past 2 years, and they want to stay active and they want to continue supporting people in Gaza and the struggle for Palestinian rights. From your perspective, what are the things you want to see people around the world doing right now? What would you call on them to do?
Yeah, actually, and I want to just say that you said that also Palestinians felt more comfortable feeling that other people outside of Gaza were talking about them. I want actually to address a very, very important issue, which is the genocide has not ended so far. So people outside of Gaza need to know that it is still ongoing, but in other ways, in other silent, less visible ways. And this is something I heard from an eyewitness, a victim of, someone who used to live in Shija'iya and was forcibly expelled after the Yellow Line expanded, etc. He told me that during the genocide, it was genocide, an internationally recognized genocide, and everyone talked about it. And this actually made us a little comfortable that there is something going on outside of Gaza that would at some point stop what is going on. But now I feel that everyone has abandoned us because they are comfortable that the ceasefire went into effect and now Palestinians are able to eat, to return to their homes, etc. And the series of killing incidents were over. They are not talking as much as they used to do during the genocide, and this is what actually makes me disappointed. I'm quoting the eyewitness I interviewed. So, and this is actually a sense that we all in Gaza feel when we see talks and reports speaking or talking about the ceasefire, etc. On the ground, it's totally different, and people outside of Gaza need to continue their advocacy, their rallies, etc., to push their authorities, their governments to make pressure on the Israeli authorities to actually end the genocide practically, not just in the news or on paper, etc. So, yeah, I think that we still need people outside of Gaza around the world to support Palestinian victims here and to be their voice when they are not heard, when Israel actually still practices genocide in a way that keeps the international community unaware of what's happening on the ground.
That's such an important point, and one that we always press, and that's why we wanted to have you join us, Maha, because we want to keep the focus on what's happening, and you and your colleagues are doing really an extraordinary job of documenting that, because as we know, the international organizations are largely not present. Nobody knows Gaza as well as you do. And as you said, because you're also living it, you can document it in a way that nobody else can. We are so grateful for the work you're doing, Maha. And we won't wait two more years to have you come back. Please know that this is your platform. So we will ask you back. But anytime you think that there's a message you want to deliver or information that you want to share with the world, this is your platform. You don't need an invitation. Just tell us, and you're welcome here anytime. And please look after yourselves the best you can. We will keep raising our voices. We'll keep sharing the work that you're doing. And we're just so grateful to you, Maha, to you and your colleagues for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much, Maha.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ali and Nora. I'm pleased to be able to take part in this. And of course, I will take part in other activities. It's been great to follow the work of Electronic Intifada throughout the past 2 years, although we were actually busy trying to survive. But I also was following up the work of Electronic Intifada, and I felt like every Palestinian more comfortable that there is a platform that is actually highlighting and giving priority to our suffering and making the world more aware of the human rights violations going on in Gaza. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think probably almost every week for the you can correct me if I'm wrong, Nora, but almost every week for the last 2 years, when Nora reads the news at the beginning of this program, as she does every week. I think in almost every show, we include information that comes from Euromed. So
it's immeasurable how important your work and the work of your colleagues is and has been to document these crimes and create dossiers on those who are perpetrating this genocide. It is such important work. So I'm so grateful, and I know that our audience is always grateful for the work that you do and all the contributions that you and your colleagues make. Thank you so much, Meha.
Thank you, Anwar. So,
we'll see you soon. Thanks soon. Very much.
Have a nice day. Bye.
And again, we apologize for the video quality, but when we are posting these videos, these segments separately to YouTube, it'll be a lot cleaner. So thanks for that, and thanks for hanging in with us.
Yeah, that was, and the audio was clear, but there was just some technical issue where because we did record it earlier this morning in Gaza, as Nora said, the sound was clear to me. The image was a little blurry, but we will put a very clear version up on YouTube separately. So don't worry about that.
Exactly.
It was amazing to be able to talk to Meha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Just, it's unbearable what people are having to live through, in Gaza. And we're so lucky that we were able to connect with her. So let's bring John Elmer on. Hello, John Elmer.
Hello. Thank you for doing that. That was an incredible interview, and Meha has been an inspiration for this past 2 years. Just the tireless work and the importance of the work, and to be doing that work while the genocide is literally happening to you in your house, in your family, in your neighborhood. I can't say enough about the work that she's done. So thanks for coming on, Meha.
Yeah. Well, last week you focused on the West Bank, and this week you're going back to Gaza. Give us a sense of what you're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, I'm going to show you a little bit of the yellow line maps. I think that will complement the work that Meha was doing. Also, a key assassination of a senior Qassam Brigade's commander outside of the purview of the ceasefire, obviously. Right. Just Israel doing whatever it wants. And the Americans seem to be backing it at every stage. I think that's been something that we've seen coming.
The ceasefire that only the Palestinians have adhered to. We need to come up with a new word for whatever this is. But all right. Well, Ali, do the honors.
Take it away, John.
All right. Thank you. All right. So you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the Resistance Report for day 804 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. It's also day 70 of the ceasefire, such as it is. I am reporting this on December the 18th. Ceasefire such as it is because 813 violations, 25 per day, 392 airstrikes, 400 people killed, 1,000 plus wounded, 95% of them civilians. Hamas says that they have submitted a detailed report on all violations to the mediators and the Joint Committee monitoring the ceasefire. So that's the Civil Military Coordination Center that Central Command, United States Central Command soldiers are operating in southern Israel. Doesn't seem to be having any effect on Israeli ceasefire violations. But let's take a look at the main mechanism by which these the death and destruction in Gaza is happening. It's because of this yellow line that Meha was talking about. If you didn't hear that report, you should go check it out in the video section. that was just before us on the show, and Maha Husseini from Euromed. They've been doing incredible work on this. So I just wanted to give a few maps here that I have shown previously, but I'm going to show them all together just to show you. So this is the first map that was released. This is the only map that people in Gaza have been given about where the yellow line is. Maha talked about the yellow blocks, and I've reported on the yellow line a few times. So we know that there are yellow blocks that mark this line. But this line really comes from, if we look at the next slide, they came from Trump's back of the napkin plan here that he and Steve Witkoff came up with while they were golfing. And basically the map line looks more or less like it was drawn on the back of a napkin on a golf cart, or that it was negotiated between golf leaders who are Witkoff's business and Jared Kushner's business associates. It does not reflect on the ground any kind of detail or fidelity to the reality on the ground, which has made it, of course, a very deadly spot for Palestinians. And it's the, as I said, the main mechanism of destruction and death, because they're shooting and killing people along that line, but also on the eastern side of that yellow line. The Israeli military continues to destroy in the same way that it was during Operation Gideon's Chariots. They're destroying the entire neighborhoods, row by row, house by house, on the eastern side of those lines. They're also setting up military bases, outposts in those in that eastern area buffer zone. It's also in that area where the IDF-backed militias that are attempting to sow discord. I mean, the Israeli black militias, they do not have any capacity to overthrow the Qassam government. They are just to cause chaos and destruction. And earlier this week, there was an assassination carried out by their forces, by their collaborator forces inside the yellow line. So they're able to move across that line and carry out attacks. So that is the Trump line. We'll look at the next one. Shows this was the one that I showed you that was up on the wall at the Civil Military Coordination Center in southern Israel. And again, you see that map looks quite a bit different than the first two maps that we see. And in this next one is the zoom in on the one that I showed you a couple weeks ago. And again, you can see the areas in that are the most important are different. And those areas are in the populated areas in the north, across Gaza City, up to Jabalia in the north. That these are neighborhoods where hundreds of thousands of people live. And so it's very significant that this line has been drawn. And earlier this month, during a visit to Beit Hanun, and Jabalia, the Israeli chief of staff, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, said that the yellow line demarcating the Israeli military's withdrawal as part of the ceasefire is, quote, a new border line. The chief of staff said, we will control parts of the Gaza Strip and stand along those strategic lines. The yellow line is a new border line, a forward defensive line for the communities. He means the communities of the Gaza envelope, the settlement communities on the outside of the Gaza Strip, the Israeli communities, and an offensive line. So it's the position that they can use to jump off for military operations or by their collaborators, as I described. If we take a look at the next map, you can see here that the BBC has showed us this right after the ceasefire agreement came into effect, that the yellow line that was drawn on those maps, such as it was still not the line that was being used for these yellow blocks. This is from October from BBC Verify, and they show 290 meters. There's places that it's up to 2 kilometers from the border over that the yellow line is squeezing the Gaza Strip. And Army Radio pointed out that this is a new reality, but the new reality shows that Israel's plans to disarm Hamas through disarm Qassam, through an international force or some force that's not the Israelis, is a pipe dream, according to Army Radio. Hamas has indeed agreed to relocate all living and arrested prisoners, but this does not in any way indicate intentions to relinquish control over security or the resistance weapons. So that's how the Israeli military sees it. And I think that's a pretty accurate description by the way the resistance sees it as well. There's not going to be a disarming of the resistance, something that the Israelis could not do in 2 years. Some other force that doesn't exist and isn't even in a blueprint form yet is not going to be doing that work. I just want to show you a couple updated yellow line maps. We're at number 5 here. And here you can see, this is from open source work done by Chris Osiek. And using these maps, you can see in the upper left corner, you can see one of the yellow blocks in the inset picture. You can see where the yellow line is on the map. But this map, this satellite mapping, shows you how many houses are in that area. So the pin that's at the bottom at the center of this map, the yellow pin, shows where that inset block is. And you can see that it's 10 houses deep from the yellow line. And that makes that entire neighborhood, thousands of people whose houses are actually inside the yellow line, but are not because of the way that Israel has moved these blocks. And these three, there's one more, number 6 we can show you. You can also see that again. You can see on this map, the red side is on the eastern side of the yellow line. And you can see all of those houses, full neighborhoods like in Shajaiya, across Zaytun, in Jabalia. These are built up areas where thousands of people are living. Shajaiya itself is one of the largest neighborhoods in all of Gaza, and it's basically been cut in half. And that's what we're seeing here. And you can see the pin, the yellow pin marks along this map showing where those yellow blocks are. And again, it's the same as the previous map. You're seeing dozens of houses deep, which means thousands, if not tens of thousands of people out of their homes because of this line. There's one more map that just shows, I just wanted to bring these maps in because they show you the houses instead of just showing Gaza as a map where nobody lives. This map shows you the number of houses, the number of families that are being impacted by this yellow line squeeze that's been going on. So that is just to complement what Maha was talking about in her interview from Gaza. Let's take a look now at number 8 this week. The senior commander, the head of military manufacturing for the Qassam Brigades, Raed Saad, was assassinated outside of the ceasefire agreement. Obviously, a blatant violation. His car that he was in, along with three associates, was hit by a drone strike on December 13th along the coastal road in Gaza City. The Israelis attempted to say that it was a response to the ceasefire to yellow line violations, but that quickly fell away when it was understood that this was a strike of opportunity. They've been attempting to assassinate Raed Saad for about 30 years. He's a key commander that his life really mirrors the growth of the Qassam Brigades from the First Intifada, when they were founded as a group of operatives, to the Second Intifada, where they started organizing more along a military lines and having concentrated military plans to drive the settlers and soldiers out of the Gaza Strip, which eventually happened after the Second Intifada during the 2005 Israeli disengagement. And after the time that Israel disengaged from Gaza, this is really the period of time that Raed Saad was a key figure in developing the systematized, programmatized weapons development and military development to turn the Qassam Brigades from a group of operatives to effectively a national army. A couple statements from was statement from the Qassam Brigades about the assassination said, with all pride, honor, defiance, and defiance, the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades exalt the ascension of one of its great men, a commander from its general military council, the martyred commander Mujahid Rahed Saad, head of military manufacturing. Our great commander departed after a long and impressive journey of sacrifice and resistance, crowned by his leadership of the al-Qassam manufacturing system, which formed one of the most important pillars of the creativity of our resistance on October 7th, and then its infliction of heavy losses on the occupation army and in confronting its aggression against our people during the Battle of Al-Aqsa Flood in Gaza. By assassinating our leaders and our people and its daily and continuous aggression against our people in various areas of the Gaza Strip, the Nazi enemy has crossed all red lines. It is disregarding Trump's plan, and Trump and the mediators must bear responsibility for these dangerous transgressions and this repeated rampage against our people and our resistance fighters, as well as our leaders. Our right to respond to the occupation's aggression is guaranteed. We have the right to defend ourselves by any means necessary. And we announce today, this was the day after Rahed Saad was killed, they said, we announce today that the al-Qassam leadership has appointed a new commander to carry out the tasks previously held by our martyred commander. Hamas also had a statement that said, as we bid farewell today to the Mujahid leader, Rahed Saad, we bid farewell to a jihadist journey that spanned more than 35 years, during which he was at the forefront, present in the fields of resistance work, contributing to the building and development of the Qassam Brigade's capabilities and enhancing its qualitative strength. He held pivotal leadership positions and played central roles in the path of the Palestinian resistance. This journey began with the launch of the First Intifada in 1987 and escalated through the successive stages of confrontation and challenge, reaching its peak in Al-Aqsa Flood, for which the martyred leader Rahed Saad played a central role in its preparation and its building plans to confront the occupation forces during a comprehensive war of annihilation that lasted for 2 years after the October 7th attack. Throughout his long journey, the martyr was subjected to several assassination attempts, which only increased his steadfastness and determination. For him, they were nothing but additional fuel to continue the resistance project and challenge the enemy and cling to the option of confrontation until the end. So those are the statements from the Qassam Brigades and from Hamas on his assassination. We can look at the next slide here, because the Israelis believed that he was a central figure in creating, in writing, and detailing the document that the Israeli security establishment calls Jericho's Wall, which was the October 7th plan, in all its detail, the details of the rockets and the blinding operation that was used to drive soldiers into their bases to allow the breaching operation, which was trained for above, outside, in the open under Yahya Sinwar, to breach the wall and have the fighters cross over and dismantle the Gaza division. The plan that he wrote was very successful in that sense. But the history of this leader is really important, because he began during the Second Intifada to work with Adnan al-Ghul to put one gun in the hand, to put weapons in the hands of every fighter, that your resistance is only as large as the number of fighters that are armed. And that project began in the Second Intifada. And of course, it developed greatly after the Israelis left Gaza in 2005 and the years of war between then. In 2006, there was the war Gilad Shalit, after the capture of Gilad Shalit, 2008, 2009, Cass led, 2012. Every couple of years, there's a war. During this time, all throughout it, Qassam was developing its capacity, and Rahed Saad was a key leader in that. He was a founding member of the Nukba forces, the elite naval commandos that the Qassam Brigade started to build out in the 2010s. That's after he had a leadership position. He was the head of the Gaza City brigade during the Intifada and the years after the Intifada. And between 2014 and 2021, he was Qassam Brigade's operations chief. These are top military positions, after which he took over as the head of military manufacturing. And of course, people who are familiar with the Resistance Report know the military manufacturing is what you've been watching for the past 2 years from the Resistance, making weaponry, testing it, developing it, putting it into service. This is a project that has been going on in the Qassam Brigades for more than 25 years, and Riyad Saad was at a central figure in that development. In the statement that the Israelis released, actually, there's one more slide. Is there one more slide of him? Yeah, on stage here in 2001 after Operation Guardians of the Wall attack. So Shabak said of Riyad Saad that Saad is responsible for the deaths of many soldiers who were killed in Gaza as a result of explosive devices manufactured by the weapons production headquarters during the war. And that is a key aspect that we have been watching for the past 2 years, the way to use that effective weaponry to not to reinvent the wheel, but to perfect the basics of anti-tank weapons, both IEDs and rockets, the Yassin 105. Both of those, the Shawad EFP and the Yassin 105, they were in development since the Second Intifada and were perfected in the years before the Al-Aqsa flood operation. And so Riyad Saad was one of the key men in deciding when the moment was right, when the weaponry was developed enough, when they had enough stockpiles that they could defend themselves for a prolonged war, which is what we saw. No weapons. They didn't run out of weapons. They were able to defend themselves all the way till the end of the war, to the point where Israel did not want to invade Gaza City because of the preparations there in Gaza City. And then if we look at the next slide, you can see him here. He was a deputy to Izzedine Al-Haddad, who is the chief of staff now for the Qassam Brigades, and blurred faces on this picture because the commander was not assassinated at the time. This is from the Al Jazeera documentary, What is Hidden is Greater, about October 7th. And you can see him, Riyad Saad, walking in behind there of Izzedine Al-Haddad. Riyad Saad, like many in Gaza, is from the Ascalon area of what is now southern Israel, driven into Gaza in 1948. Driven into a detention camp in the years after 1948, before being sent into the Gaza Strip in the early 1950s. That is the story of many of Gaza's population. More than 80% are refugees or descendants of refugees. So significant leader, significant loss. But as Qassam said, and as they have done with every other loss of a leader, they replace him immediately. The PFLP, if we look at the next slide, you can see PFLP celebrated their 58th anniversary this week, but they also, the Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades, sent out a statement about Riyad Saad that said, "With immense pride and honor, the martyr Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades, the military wing of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, mourn the great leader, martyr Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, martyred leader Riyad Saad, who ascended as a martyr on the path of Al-Quds and Palestine, along with a group of his comrades in a cowardly Zionist assassination. That blood shed for freedom and dignity stands as a testament to the loyalty of its owners, of their national message, and their bearing the trust of defending our people and our cause. It is blood that exposes the brutality of aggression and confirms that the will of the people is stronger than to be broken, and that the path of liberation is paved by the steadfastness of those who choose to stand against oppression, no matter how fierce the storms." So that's from the PFLP, and you can see their poster there that says, the sun will not kneel before you, O dawn of freedom. It says there, as you can see, the muzzle of the AK bursting through the wall there on that poster that was released this week. There's another PFLP poster here on their 58th anniversary, saying that 58 years of unwavering resistance and indomitable will, and the slogan remains, "Palestine, all of Palestine. So that is from the PFLP. Marked their anniversary this week. Interestingly, they marked their anniversary, as they do every year, by doing community service. So we saw the PFLP cadre out in the streets of Gaza cleaning up the destruction, working with the civil defense to get to clean up and to repair the city on their own, not waiting for international help on that. Palestinians have long ago begun the rebuilding process. But also PFLP Deputy Secretary General Jamir Metzar said in a speech this week that we affirm that the weapon of resistance is a political issue and part of the tasks of the national consensus on the national political strategy, not part of the occupation's conditions. So that's about disarming. They're not disarming on the occupation's conditions. The Palestinian resistance factions have said they will disarm in the sense that they will turn their weapons over to the national army once the Palestinian state has been created. So strong statements there from the PFLP as well. And of course, the left always saluting the Qassam Brigades and other factions. The joint operations room and the ability of these factions to work together has been one of the real testaments to the battle that we have been witnessing over the last 2 years. Now, if we look at the next one, we're at number 14 here, I believe. Tamar, are we? Yes. Yes. This is the RADA unit. This is the deterrence force set up by the resistance internal security working under the Ministry of the Interior, released an amnesty after the death of Yasser Abu Shabab, who is an Israeli collaborator that was killed earlier this month. This is the second amnesty that resistance security, this is all resistance factions together, have offered to the collaborators that were working with the Israelis either during the war or since. And this particular poster that we're seeing was distributed around Gaza. The text says the door of repentance has been opened for collaborators affiliated with IDF-backed militias supported by the occupation for a period of only 10 days. 9 days remain. Turn yourself into the security of the resistance so that every person involved may place their fate in their own hands before the time to go back is lost. In the hashtags there say time is running out, and they're using the time is running out statement, hashtag line and imagery that was used for the prisoners throughout the war as well. And the Interior Ministry confirmed that legal cases are proceeding for people that have turned themselves in. And the Interior Minister said, your fate is sealed. Return to the embrace of your people before it is too late. This next slide shows them counting this down. 3 days left. Time is running out. The decision is in your hands. There are 3 days and time is running out. The next slide is down to 2 days. This was earlier this week. Admitting a mistake is courageous, the poster says. There is no time to wait. Only 2 days remaining and the time is running out. So resistance security backed by the clans in Gaza and prominent families in Gaza who are on side with this program of bringing collaborators in. And of course, we can see on this next slide that the deterrence force released this poster after the death of Yasser Abu Shabab that said, as we told you, Israel will not protect you when he was killed earlier this month. The Assembly of Palestinian Tribes and Clans in Gaza said, we are proud and honored by the extent of the societal rejection of the abnormal situation of this treacherous mercenary group, which acts as guard dogs and mercenaries for the benefit of the occupation army only. We appreciate the national stance of the Taraban clan, that was Yasser Abu Shabab's clan, which lifted tribal cover from the so-called Yasser Abu Shabab and disavowed him during his life and after his death. They said, let Yasser Abu Shabab be a lesson. So significant popular support for routing out these Israeli-backed militias. Maybe we'll dig into those on a future program. They are not a formidable threat. They are simply chaos agents. And one more slide here. Saraya al-Quds this week also through spokesman Abu Hamza said that we in Sarail Quds closed the file of the enemy's captives with us after we handed over the last body last Wednesday, December the 2nd, in the northern Gaza Strip as part of the honorable deal resulting from the heroic battle we fought with all pride, honor, and loyalty, in which we have affirmed that the enemy's captives will not return except by decision of the resistance or in coffins. So the turnover of captives, which was Israel's war goal, was to return them through violence, failed. They got them back through negotiation. Of course, their Israelis are reneging on that negotiation, but Sarail Quds is not. Sarail's statement went on to say that we affirm that Sarail Quds and the resistance factions adhered to all the provisions of the agreement stipulated for the first phase of the ceasefire agreement and the end of the barbaric Zionist war of genocide against our people. And we call on the mediators and the guarantors to pressure the enemy to implement its commitments related to the agreement and stop its repeated criminal violations. Now, some of the last few prisoners, captives to be handed over, were handed over by Sarail Quds. They were not in the hands of the Qassam Brigade, something that we've known since October the 7th. Sarail Quds here saying that they have turned over their last body. There still remains one body of an Israeli soldier in Gaza that has not been returned. The ICRC and the Qassam Brigades and the Shadow Unit are looking for that body still. And that is the resistance report for day 804 of Israel's genocide. Just reminder that if you have missed any of the resistance reports, we have a convenient playlist on our YouTube channel for past episodes of the resistance report, so you can find them there.
Thank you so much, John. I mean, you know, as you said, I think a couple weeks ago, in terms of the phase two of this so-called ceasefire, this alleged ceasefire, the ceasefire as it is, they're kicking the can down the road, the Israelis, backed by, of course, international Western powers. Trying to really set up Gaza and the current situation right now, which is this low-level ongoing genocide. The ceasefire has not actually been implemented on the ground for people in Gaza who are still experiencing genocide, to just kind of like make that the norm and to normalize this low-level killing spree that Israel gets to keep engaging in while taking more land, while militarizing the so-called yellow line. Where do the negotiations stand at this point?
The negotiations for phase two have begun in modest ways, I suppose you could say. The whole thing about the Trump plan was it was essentially everybody agreeing to see what happens, right? To agreeing to what Trump had said he will do, without any real concrete steps, because the proposal at Sharm el-Sheikh was defined by its vagueness. It had a lot of things in it, alluded to things in it that Israel wanted, and we've seen since that point and the setup of the CMCC with Central Command soldiers in southern Israel, that there are Americans monitoring this ceasefire 24 hours a day around the clock, with live drone footage coming in constantly. But it hasn't seemed to made any impact on Israel. They still carried out this high profile assassination, which is, significantly outside of the scope of yellow line attacks. This is a top commander in the Qassam Brigades, and to do the equivalent in the Israeli military, you're talking the most senior members here. At this point in the battle, he's the number two man in Qassam. So to be able to just carry out an assassination like that and not have any word from the Americans, Trump Trump said he was looking into it, but that was days later, and we still haven't heard anything from that. I showed you on this program a couple weeks ago what it looks like inside that monitoring center, and they would know the moment the assassination happened. And yeah. Israel even admitted that they didn't tell the Americans until 20 minutes after the assassination. So there was no, they didn't tell the Americans they were going to carry out this operation. So while it's American backed, there's no feeling of legitimacy for this ceasefire. Now 70 days on, it hasn't increased the amount of aid in any meaningful way. As you reported in the newscast, the lack of shelter units that were supposed to come, the caravans, the ATCO trailers that were supposed to be coming in are not happening. There's not enough shelter. There's not enough tents. There's not enough tarps. All of these things were guaranteed in the ceasefire agreement that Qassam and Hamas agreed to in phase one. Yeah. So there's still a lot of phase one that has not been adhered to. And we're moving on to phase two, which basically the way I read phase two is it doesn't have there's not going to be negotiations on phase two, because phase two is full withdrawal of the Israeli military. It's, you know, the road to a Palestinian state, sovereignty over their borders, opening of the crossings. And Israel doesn't seem in a position to be doing any of those things. No. They've got their captives back, and
right.
They're just going with low level war.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they've had complete green light to do whatever. There are no lines that they can cross anymore. They've been testing and testing, and each time they test and they go a little farther, and the so-called international community, the world courts, of course the spigot, that is flowing in terms of arms trade and funding for these war crimes, just doesn't get turned off at all. Why would they start adhering to any sort of agreement that they supposedly signed?
But at the same time, things are not going. It's been a couple of weeks since we talked about the whole Trump plan and the Board of Peace, but partly because nothing is happening there. It's yeah. not progressing. We talked a week or two ago about how the U.S. can't get anyone to sign up for the so-called International Stabilization Force. And they have now more than once delayed the announcement of the so-called Board of Peace, because apparently they can't get anyone who's willing to join it, because it's so compromised and so discredited yeah. at the outset. Going back to our discussion a few weeks ago with Craig Mukhaibar, the international lawyer who, like me and like us, has been extremely critical of the UN resolution that passed, that sort of authorized this Trump plan or gave it a veneer of UN legitimacy. At the time, we were very critical of Russia and China for not vetoing that resolution. And I maintain that position. They should mm-hmm. have vetoed it, absolutely, because the precedent it set of going back more than 100 years to the colonial style mandates of the League of Nations is totally has no place in the 21st century. That said, I'll concede that they probably understood that this would go nowhere, and therefore letting it pass would, there would be a good chance that the United States would fall flat on its face. And that's what is happening. But the worry that I had at the time, and that many of us had and is still playing out, is that what they're going to do is just maintain the status quo yeah. in Gaza of siege, blockade, devastation. The situation Maha Husseini told us about, where the genocide continues and almost nothing has changed, which is why we need pressure from anywhere else. And just one other thing, yeah. and the U.S. is now at the stage of as they were with the International Stabilization Force, of leaking prematurely or without basis the names of countries that would contribute troops to the International Stabilization Force, you know, in the hope of generating momentum and spin, and then none of it materializes. They're now doing the same with the Board of Peace. So just yesterday, a U.S. official or U.S. officials, unnamed U.S. officials, leaked to the Times of Israel, or claimed to the Times of Israel, that it has secured commitments from Egypt, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, Italy, and Germany to have their leaders join U.S. President Donald Trump on the Board of Peace. No official announcements about that. Maybe it will happen. But what does that change? I mean, these genocidal countries and their vassals move from the Security Council to the so-called Board of Peace. So, you know, it is... I think it's worth reminding ourselves that while the situation in Gaza is absolutely dire, that things don't, you know, the U.S. cannot just dictate what happens. They also cannot impose their reality on Gaza.
No one of any significance will agree to be on the Board of Peace, but, and yet everyone seems to agree that Tony Blair won't be on the Board of Peace after all, so... They're thankful for small mercies, I guess.
I mean, what do you even say? It's just, it's like a deranged, you know, we've said this before, it's like some deranged colonial fantasy. And even if it's not Tony Blair, it'll be some other, you know, ghoulish colonial enforcer. If it even, you know, if it even happens at all, of course. And, you know, as John, as you've talked about, they'll still have to get through the resistance in Gaza before they even try to enact any sort of this colonial, you know, arrogance on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, well, the siege was supposed to be a key factor in ending the war. The end of the war, the return of the captives, and the end of the blockade was a key priority for Qassam, obviously, and it is for the people in Gaza. And when the U.S. took over the aid delivery, they said that their civil military cooperation center was going to be in charge of aid to do the logistics. That's what they say their soldiers are doing, the logistics for the aid delivery. But we have seen aid deliveries increase, but increase from genocidal level to you know, somewhat less genocidal. They're still blocking, as you had in your news report, Nora, they're still blocking any kind of medical system rehabilitation, reconstruction. They're not allowing in spare parts. They're not allowing fuel in, because then Palestinians can rebuild for themselves. They can use their generators. They can use their what heavy equipment they have, which is very slim at this point, because Israel carried out a systematic attack from the beginning of the war on civil defense and Gaza municipalities over all of the different areas of Gaza to destroy their heavy equipment. And so you're seeing scenes every day of trying to get Palestinians who have been buried in the rubble out, and you see civil defense working with like hand saws to try to get an 18-story building that's pancaked one floor on the other to try to get people out. But you have these Egyptians are all for giving their front-end loaders, as long as those front-end loaders are looking for Israelis. And they travel around with Egyptian flags flying off the back, as if they're supposed to be proud of the fact that they have given these pieces of heavy machinery to Gaza. But those pieces are only used for finding Israeli captives.
Then after the captives' bodies are found, they're driven right back across.
Well, we saw the first ones being used this week for Palestinians in Gaza City. 68 days after the ceasefire was the first time that equipment was being used in downtown Gaza City to find, I think it was the Abu Salem family that was more than 150 people killed in a single building. But it just gives you an idea of what is all over Gaza. And this is just the beginning. I mean, the ICRC is not bringing in DNA kits to do any of the forensics for the people that Israel's handed over. So they're still not clear on the names of the people that have been handed over by Israel. Yet you see this this program for finding Israelis within Gaza. So
can we look at this? Can we look at this article, Tamara? I'm just going to give you this link, which just came out while we've been on air in the Wall Street Journal. And I think it really underscores a lot of the points that, John, you've been making and that we've been making over the past few weeks. And it just was literally published a few minutes ago. And it says Trump's Gaza peace plan stumbles over Hamas disarmament. And it says President Trump's phased peace plan for Gaza is struggling to move beyond its initial stage, hitting obstacles in Hamas's refusal to disarm and Israel's unwillingness to retreat from the enclave until that happens.
Hamas is being the petulant ones, right?
Well, obstacles. Yeah, of course. This is the spin from the right-wing Wall Street Journal. But what it is saying, the point that it's saying that is that basically you cannot impose through a so-called peace plan what you failed to gain on the battlefield. And that's what this is saying. Yes, they're going to put this spin on it where they try and blame Hamas. But the point is that Israel has failed in its stated goal of destroying Hamas. All their declarations of victory, all their declarations of success, they have to admit time and again that's just not the case. And they say in this article this peace plan was the best plan on the table at the moment to stop the fighting, said Amin Mehvar, senior Middle East analyst for the non-profit monitor ACLED. I'm skipping a bit. The Trump administration is hoping to recruit 10,000 troops that would serve under a U.S. general for Gaza, but officials have acknowledged it would take most of next year to get them in place. So, I mean, that gives you an idea. The most immediate problem is that no country is willing to commit troops to an international stabilization force if it means they may have to fight Hamas. Meanwhile, the U.S. is pushing for an initial deployment that would operate only in areas controlled by Israel. But that is also problematic for for foreign governments, particularly Arab states that oppose Israel's continued presence in the Gaza Strip, because it would give the appearance that they are propping up an Israeli occupation. No one wants to be seen as doing Israel's dirty work, said Mehvar of ACLED. So that's the stumbling block. So I won't be surprised to see if, you know, this force keeps getting pushed off again and again and again, and the so-called Board of Peace gets pushed back again and again and again. But in the meantime, the situation in Gaza is not getting better. It's only getting worse. And so that's where really we have to, you know, as people, as civil society, we have to be that force for speaking out, for demonstrating, for rallying, for putting pressure on these governments that they can't go back to just ignoring the situation. It's untenable for people in Gaza, and it will explode again. You know, I mean, the idea that Israel has neutralized the resistance and there won't be another quote unquote October 7th is absurd. Not only is the resistance still there with its arms intact, as John shows us, but also as Israel and the US acknowledge, because why would they be demanding that Hamas disarms if the Israeli claims were true that they had destroyed and defeated Hamas? By the way, the same is true in Lebanon, where they keep saying, we struck this big strategic blow against Hezbollah and we destroyed them and we, you know, the, then why do you need them to disarm? What's the big deal? If you won, why do you need them to disarm?
Yeah, the very fact the Wall Street Journal is saying in that article in the first paragraph that it's Trump's plan has hit these obstacles because of Hamas's refusal to disarm. I mean, yeah, but what I thought Hamas means, was defeated.
Right. Yeah, not only was Hamas not defeated, not only does the resistance still have its weapons, but now you have even more people motivated to resist. More people who would be willing to sign up and be trained and fight an entity, an army that has committed such evil above and beyond the decades of evil. So what has Israel achieved other than inflicting suffering? Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting the way that the resistance handled this, right? They didn't come out and say, we're going to kill any foreign force that comes, and they didn't say it all the time. They didn't repeat it. They just said it a couple of times that they said that any foreign force will be considered an occupier. You know, they understated it, but it was there in their communications, you know, and I think that that message, along with 2 years of resistance videos that I'm sure at least some of the people involved in setting up a military, if you're talking about militaries of all of these countries that would participate, you can be sure that their militaries had watched the guerrilla warfare in Gaza. So just to subtly say, you know, that any foreign, which is a principled position that they have always had, the Palestinians have not been asking for example, a United Nations force to stand between Israel. That has not ever been a demand of the resistance or of the people in Palestine. These are all foreign ideas. But just to simply say and stick with their long term position, which is that any foreign force will be considered an occupier. And I think that message,
as they should,
got through.
Yeah. Okay. So we also wanted to bring up a couple of, before we go to the, let's just do it. The globalize the intifada phrase that,
that I've never heard anyone use, except like pro-Israel fanatics who are obsessed with it. It's their new thing. They used it with Zohran Mamdani. Like he'd never said it, but he was forced to renounce this phrase he'd never used.
Which is shameful.
Yeah, I mean, it does.
Yeah,
I mean,
bring us up to date. What is happening in the UK? I mean, the UK, it's like playing whack-a-mole. They're trying to ban the words Palestine Action along with the group. Of course, they're putting people who are part of Palestine Action in prison. They're now on hunger strike. And now they're trying to ban the words globalize the intifada and are coming up with wild lies about what that means, what intifada means, what it's translated to. And it's pretty remarkable. So walk us through what's happening in the UK.
Yeah, it's one of these kind of periodic moral panics we have here in the UK. There was a period earlier this year, I think it was, or perhaps last year, I don't know, it just seems to be one crisis after the next here in this crazy country, like you said, Norris, a bit like whack-a-mole. But at a certain point, there was a similar moral panic about in the, you know, the lousy British media about the slogan "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," which does get used, rightly so, as it should be. Globalize the Intifada, it is a rarer slogan, but it does get used from time to time. But yeah, I mean, this is the new thing that they're sort of that the Israel lobbyists have been trying to get rid of for a long time, or any mention of, just like one mention of the word intifada on a sign at a protest or something like that, they'll sort of cry anti-Semitism about that. But the news, the concerning news this week was that there was two people arrested yesterday at a protest in London for apparently chanting "Globalize the Intifada" or using the slogan in some fashion. It's unclear exactly what. And there was two people arrested. Interestingly, this BBC article actually in its first draft mentions, towards the end of the article, mentions that a little bit about the historical context of the word intifada, and it said that it was used, it first came to prominence in the West during the first intifada of the late 80s and early 90s, which it described as largely unarmed, accurately. I mean, it would have been more accurate to say almost entirely unarmed. But nonetheless, even that wasn't good enough, and it has been changed in this version of the article. Clearly, the call went in from the usual suspects. But yeah, two people were arrested, and it comes after the Israel lobbyists and government ministers recently said that it should be banned. Well, first of all, we got a short clip from a government minister, Wes Streeting, about that. Yeah, oh God, indeed.
Do you think protesters who use that phrase should be prosecuted? Well, what are you going to do?
In terms of changes to the law, those are decisions for the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary. I'm not aware of plans at this time to change the law.
Opinion?
To change the law in that way.
Do you think it should be?
And I'm not going to step outside my lane now and to start making decisions for the Home Secretary and the Prime Minister.
I'm not asking to make decisions.
But look,
for that.
I don't. I mean, put it this way. I think that
you've just given a very strong answer about standing with Jewish people.
Yeah, globalise the Intifada is not an expression simply of solidarity with the Palestinian people and their just cause. Globalise the Intifada is received by and seen as support for terrorist action against Jewish people.
This guy is such a snake, honestly. Like, yeah. Wes Streeting, for context, is the health minister. So he's a sort of mid-level minister, but he's you know, he has a fair degree of authority, and he's actually viewed as a potential future prime minister. Mm-hmm. And he has been really groomed. I mean, he's been a Zionist since he was a student activist. Like, he was the head of the National Union of Students at some point some decades ago. And he's an ultra Blairite as well. Like, he's a big supporter of the former prime minister, neoliberal prime minister Tony Blair, who of course took over the Labour Party with his new so-called New Labour project. So, you know, what this guy says definitely has an influence, especially as, you know, he's regarded as there's a lot of talk recently about a potential leadership challenge by him to the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. So, you know, him saying that definitely has had an effect on the discourse. He's also been funded directly by pro-Israel lobbyists, as have half of the cabinet. Of the British cabinet, so, you know, soon around about the same time, and soon after that, the police then put out a statement clarifying. The police in Manchester and in London put out a statement saying that they would be more assertive in interpreting the law, and they would make arrests around when the phrase was used, which led to these arrests yesterday. We've got a statement from the Board of Deputies of British Jews, which is a extremely pro-Israel organisation, which has a close working relationship with the Embassy of Israel to use some of its own private documents. And they said they strongly welcome what they call a necessary intervention by the phrase by the police around the use of this slogan, and they're trying to relate it to the mass shooting that occurred on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, which, you know, news reports have said was allegedly carried out by, you know, the two suspects were, you know, supposed to have been or investigated to have been part of an ISIS cell. And of course, ISIS doesn't use the phrase globalized intifada. It's not part of their ideology in any way. You know, the word intifada, of course, as we know, and I'm sure as most of our viewers will know, it simply is the Arabic word for uprising. And in the context of the Palestinians and global solidarity with the Palestinians, it means supporting that uprising, supporting an uprising against occupation.
We often get people say, you know, Zionist critics, oh, the electronic intifada, they have violence in their name. There's nothing violent about the word intifada. It's an assertion of popular mobilization, of people struggling together to achieve their rights. Those who are violent are the ones who during the first intifada of the late 1980s, brutally murdered Palestinians, children, kids, young people going out to demonstrate. Those who, you know, what intifada means for Palestinians is how Palestinians across the West Bank and Gaza in the late 80s and early 90s organized schools and universities and kindergartens in their homes clandestinely because Israel shut down all schooling at every level for 3 years during the Intifada. So that's what an Intifada is. You know, you could say that the civil rights movement in the U.S. was an Intifada. Mm-hmm. You could
the
say
the Warsaw
that,
Ghetto uprising.
Issue, didn't it, during Mamdani's primary campaign,
yes,
didn't it?
Because but it there was. The point is, like, I don't think he had ever used the phrase, or if he'd used it, it's not a phrase people are. It's just one of these things that they're latching onto. It's become kind of a litmus test. How many politicians can we get to condemn the phrase globalize the intifada, which I'll be, I mean, I'm not saying no one ever uses it at a protest, but I've been to protests for decades, or Palestine solidarity events for decades, and I can't honestly remember a time when I've heard people earnestly use the phrase globalize the intifada. It's just become one of these things they want to use to bash everyone into submission, just like with the phrase from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which is a lovely and wonderful phrase. What's wrong with that? It's like saying from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, South Africa will be free. Does that mean that ending apartheid means, harming white people? No, it doesn't. It means ending their racial and colonial privilege and them having the same rights as everyone else. That's what it means for Palestine to be free from the river to the sea. It means an end to what B'Tselem has called the regime of Jewish supremacy throughout historic Palestine from the river to the sea. And by the way, of course, from the river to the sea is a phrase that Zionists use all the time to refer
to. It's on their flag.
Yeah, but so they take these words, these phrases that either aren't very relevant, like globalize the intifada, or they distort them and give them, like, somehow calling for Palestine to be free is calling for a genocide of the Jewish people. They're such liars. And it's all in bad faith, and no one should pander to it. And these politicians who dance like puppets on a string are absolutely disgusting. And, well, I mean, I'm not sure what my point was. That was my point. But I don't know. What will come? Are we still allowed to say globalize the electronic intifada?
Well, now we can.
So here, I'm going to invite everyone to globalize the electronic intifada by sharing our articles, our live streams, liking and subscribing to our YouTube channel or on Rumble or on Instagram, Twitch, on Facebook. Yes, help globalize the electronic intifada by sharing the wonderful journalism we do and the wonderful articles that our contributors in Gaza write. Let's really globalize the electronic intifada.
I love that.
Well, we've got one more item to show. There was a really good point made by the human rights lawyer Tayeb Ali from a partner at the Bynum's law firm, and also He is involved with the International Center of Justice for Palestinians. And he said that calls to ban globalize the Intifada are legally wrong and politically dangerous. Speech is not criminal because it is provocative. Under UK law, it must incite violence or terrorism. The slogan is ambiguous and widely used to mean global protest, boycott, legal and political pressure, not violence. Intifada literally means shaking off and has long included mass civil resistance. Context matters. So, yeah, I mean, it's just another example, as Tayyip says, of how the British state is trying to criminalise different forms of protest in the UK.
Because that always works.
Yeah.
It always works. All right. So I just want to reiterate that we will not have a show next week because it is the Eid of Christians for Christmas. But we will be back on December 30th for a special year-end questions and answer show. That's Tuesday, December 30th at the usual time. You can send in your questions in advance if you want to using the email address questions@electronicintifada.net. We'll also be taking questions from the live comments during the show. And just like last year, we hope it'll be a good opportunity to talk about the year that has just passed and what we might expect in 2026. So again, bring your questions on any aspects of the topics we cover, and we'll have a lively discussion and maybe even some special surprise guests. We'll send out a reminder about the special questions and answer show by email a day or two before. So if you haven't signed up to our email list, now is a great time to do so, so you don't miss the reminder. And of course, just go to electronicintifada.net, click Get Updates. And again, that is Tuesday, December 30th at the usual bat time, usual bat channel. Again, questions@electronicintifada.net. And Ali, did you want to add to that?
Sorry. Oh yeah, no. Just it'll be fun. We'll have a discussion. You know, we'll take questions. You can send them in, of course, in advance if you want to, and we'll pick some. But we'll also be taking questions from the live comments on the various platforms where we'll be streaming live. So it should be a good fun. All the questions you have for John, for Asa, for me, for Nora, and perhaps, like you said, Nora, we'll have a surprise guest or two.
Yeah, it'll be great. Again, that's Tuesday, December 30th. At the usual time, and we'll send out a reminder. So there will be no show next Thursday on the 25th. Ali, let's take a look at the website. And I know you wanted to talk about the news story that we just published last night from Abu Bakr.
Yes, well, there's lots of great stuff. The big splash on the front page there is a piece by our colleague, Michael Brown, about Israel's efforts to rebrand itself during the genocide. That's a good read. And then right below that is this piece that we just published today by our colleague Abu Bakr Abed. And it's a really interesting piece. Some whistleblowers from the Committee to Protect Journalists spoke to Abu Bakr. Now, this is an organization that is, you know, it's a big non-profit press freedom organization. But what the whistleblowers revealed is that Jody Ginsburg, the organization's CEO, is really trying to suppress, or this is how they describe it, to suppress research on Israel's crimes against journalists in Gaza, to kind of massage the language that the organization uses, the way that they use the word genocide very rarely or cautiously, only with attribution. And at the same time, they say that Jody Ginsburg is currying the support of major pro-Israel donors, including several publications owned by Rupert Murdoch, who owns News Corp and, you know, many big pro-Israel publications. And so these whistleblowers who describe themselves as former and current staff at CPJ are very disturbed by this and have been trying to fight an internal battle to get this press freedom organization to actually rise to the challenge of defending the journalists in Gaza, so many of whom have paid with their lives to tell us the truth of what's happening. So it's really a brilliant, brilliant piece of work by Abu Bakr, and we're really delighted to publish it today.
Yeah. So please go give that a read. That's called Is Committee to Protect Journalists Scared of Its Pro-Israel Donors by Abu Bakr Abed. We also have some incredible... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I just wanted to point out another piece we published this week by Abdurrahman Ismail. It's this beautiful piece, Prepare Yourself, You Leave at Dawn. Abdurrahman is a filmmaker and journalist from Gaza. He's also from Deir al-Balah. And, he and Abu Bakr are also close colleagues. And he, in August, was able to leave Gaza and go to Ireland to take up a scholarship. When I went to Ireland, to Dublin in August, he was one of the people I met, and it was very emotional to meet Abdurrahman for the first time after seeing his amazing work through the genocide in Gaza and communicating with him while he was in Gaza. It was a dream come true to see him in person, and we've just published his account of that journey out of Gaza, Prepare Yourself, You Leave at Dawn, and it's really a moving account. And for every young Palestinian, and he was able to leave Gaza and take up a scholarship in Ireland that he'd been offered. And for everyone who's left Gaza in these circumstances, it is a heartbreaking and heartrending reality to leave your family, your community, your friends. And, it's always a bittersweet thing. And Abdurrahman has such a way with words in telling that story.
Yeah.
And, it's just an extraordinary piece.
Yes, and there are so many features and news articles and analyses on electronicintifada.net right now. There's, of course, our colleague Maureen Murphy's Palestine in Pictures, which is always just a meticulous and highly curated collection of images and newsy items from the month prior. So please go give that a look. We are always so grateful for Maureen for putting that together every month. It's super important. And of course, everyone at the Electronic Intifada is always very grateful for your continued support financially of this project. Ali, who do we have to thank this week?
So many people, and just a reminder that this time of year we are doing our annual campaign to raise all the resources we need for the year ahead, to continue bringing you all this coverage, to continue supporting our colleagues in Gaza so they can keep doing their work. And if you want to be among the supporters, you can go to electronicintifada.net and click Donate Now. If you are watching on YouTube, there are links in the description for our donation platform where you can, if you're able to, make a gift. And for all those who already have, we are so deeply grateful to you for enabling the work we do. And I'm just going to mention a few names. There's too many. We're blessed that there's too many to name everyone, but I just want to shout out a few people who have been so generous over the past week, and some over the past year, who are giving monthly donations, which is also an option, like Sabrina. But also I want to thank Fuad, Jean-Paul, Sarah, Gautam, Salim, Michael, Nevenka, Rupa, Ivor, Judith, Hector, Susan, Nihad, Helen, Kulsoom, and I also want to thank Tawfiq, Roger, Teresa, Susan, And Evelyn, thank you for your lovely letter. I read it to the team before we came on air. We were so touched by your words. And I want to thank Chris and his mom if they're watching. Thank you for sending me the Peace and Planet news, which was great to read from Veterans for Peace and the Capitol Hill Citizen. I got those and I have been reading them. So I really appreciate that you sent those to me. And so to everyone, we are so grateful for your support, for making this possible. Everything you see is thanks to you. And that's what keeps us strong. You are the ones who help us globalize the Electronic Intifada and share this information free of charge to everyone in the world. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Ali. And of course, I want to thank our producer and director, Tamara Nassar, for everything that she does. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you to Michael F. Brown for fact-checking, Ellie Gerzon for social media, Pierre Loisel for putting the radio packages together, Maureen Claire Murphy, everyone at the Electronic Intifada, of course. You can go to electronicintifada.net to donate now, sign up for our email list, all the things. We are, again, taking a break next week, but we will be back on December 30th. So we'll see you then. And on behalf of everyone, Asa, John, Tamara, and Ali, and myself, thank you all. And we'll see you on the 30th. Thank you.